Good morning.
Good morning. One more time.
Hi, Deirdre Delancey.
Good morning. I am Debbie Johnson. I have the pleasure of being the chair-elect of Leadership Austin. And I suspect some of you are having a better morning than others this morning, post-election hangovers. But in any case, it was a very historic event. That being that Austin is moving to single-member districts. And we've talked a lot about that. I'm sorry, I'm distracted by this mic, which keeps slipping. Bear with me just a moment. We've talked a lot about that at Leadership Austin, how important this whole leadership change is. And in fact, we think it's probably one of the most significant leadership changes that has happened in Austin in the past couple decades. So with that in mind, Leadership Austin has partnered with KLRU Austin, KUT, the Annette Strauss Institute, and we're going to sponsor a series of conversations for the runoff elections. Now, for those of you who are taking last count, my last count was 8 districts are in runoffs and the mayor. So that's a lot of conversations. And I use the word conversations very intentionally. Because if you think about what's taken place before now, it's been a series of debates. It's really, where do you stand on the issues? This one is intentionally designed to be a conversation about leadership. How do the candidates feel about leading Austin? What is their approach to leadership? What is their approach to governance? So, KLRU is going to be filming a series of sessions, free and open to the public. These will take place over the course of 3 nights, so get out your calendars, November 11th, November 12th, November 13th. And they will be featuring the runoffs in successive nights, so we've grouped the districts into different evenings. So all 8 plus 1. Probably 3 per night, I guess, but we'll see how it shakes out. And we would love to see all of you come out for these sessions. Come to one, come to all 3. The mayor will be one of the sessions, I believe on the last night. So go to leadershipaustin.org for more information and or to register. So I know with all the elections, you're anxious to hear from the panelists this morning. But before we do that, we need to make one special thanks to the Austin Board of Realtors, who is the presenting sponsor for this breakfast series. And I'd like to ask Paul Hogers to come up and just say a few words before we turn it over to the panelists.
Good morning. I see some old friends in this audience. I am Paul Hilgert, the CEO of the Austin Board of Realtors, and I will say a few words. they're not free, so listen, I want to tell you how proud the Austin Board of Realtors is to be part of this whole team of helping to provide an opportunity for Austin to be engaged in very serious times for this city. You guys are the stalwarts, obviously, because some of you have had very little sleep, I'm very sure. Some of you had very little sleep. So this is your breakfast or maybe your dinner. I do think that it is really critical for each one of you to think about how you can help others, reach out to others to be engaged in the most significant leadership change, governance change, not just for the election. I just tell you one quick thing that I thought about. You know, in one of my lives, I was the district director for Congressman Jake Pickle. It was the greatest experience of my life. And the most fun thing about it was I was really never involved in the campaigns. It was awesome. Because I didn't have to worry about doing anything except making Mr. Pickle and helping him to be the very best congressman that I could help him to be, which he didn't need a lot of help. It was the easiest job in the world. But the reality was that it was about governing, not about getting elected. But as LBJ said, you can't be a statesman unless you get elected. And so this process we go through in the next month and a half is really critical, that we have people who are listening, engaging, And so I encourage you to all go find 10 people, sit by the TV, and instead of watching just the football games, tape those debates and those conversations and talk amongst yourselves about, like you used to do in old, in your homes, about what was happening and who was gonna make decisions that would affect all of us. We have a great relationship with Leadership Austin. I'm always very proud to be next to Robert Hadlock, who, as I've said before, is kind of an institution now in Austin. KXAN is the most, in my judgment, community-minded network of news professionals that we have, and we have a lot of good ones here, but KXAN goes the extra mile to make sure they're educating the community about critical issues, and that's as few words as I can say when I get up this early. Thank you very much for letting me say that.
Thank you very much, Paul, for the kind words, and welcome everyone. A lot on the plate this morning. Let's get right to it. Our panelists today are Deidre DeLisi, who is the partner of DeLisi Communications, a public relations and government relations consulting firm. She previously served as chief of staff to Governor Rick Perry. Mike Cannon is the publisher of the Austin Monitor, an online publication that brings together the news from Austin City Hall, Travis County Commissioner's Court, and multiple other civic entities that make key decisions for Central Texas. Former council member with us today, Randy Shade, joining us. She's bringing to this conversation experience from her many roles within the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. Here along with me is my KXAN colleague, UT grad himself, Phil Prazen. He represents your voice in the discussion today, and we'll be sharing your thoughts and questions submitted through text messaging. Join the conversation. Take a look at the little piece of paper on your table. You can just text us at 22333 and enter ENG 1415 at the beginning of your question, and we're going to get it underway here. We'd like to acknowledge a couple of folks that are here. One of them may be the next mayor of Austin. Mike Martinez is here after a very long night. Also, with a smile on his face this morning, Travis County Commissioner Gerald Daugherty. And let me get kicked off here, getting your first reactions to what happened last night, Deidre.
You know, I think the Texas Tribune headline today sums it up pretty well. It was a clean sweep with a red broom. It was a tidal wave, unlike anything we've seen for Republicans in this state and country since 1994. It was a huge night across the board for the state, for Republicans nationally, picking up the Senate, statewide, again, winning all of the statewide elected positions, 8 new senators in the Texas Senate. It'll be a very different legislature coming in. It was huge. And the governor's races across the country. We now elected a Republican governor in Maryland. I don't think a lot of people saw that coming. A Republican governor in Illinois, which is viewed as a very significant repudiation of President Obama in his own hometown. So it was a huge night for. It was actually very fun to be at ACL as a Republican last night.
Mike? Well, I think locally it was something different. We got, I think we wrote this morning that there was one very clear result, and that, of course, was on rail, and about 8 very unclear results, or at least results that whittled down a long list to a slightly less long list of candidates that will be running around for the next 6 weeks. You know, I think just looking real quickly at the numbers, just the very early look at the numbers, about 14,000 people voted in the rail election that neglected to vote in the mayoral election, and I'm sure there'll be a lot to be said about that and what that means in the next few days.
Randy?
I was going to, first, I'm glad to be here. It was kind of interesting to watch the local races and see if it was going to really impact the numbers of who votes, and I'd also noticed that more people voted in the rail than in the mayoral race, and also as you look down ballot, and I got a lot of feedback from a lot of people that was, you know, was essentially paralysis because it was so overwhelming to think about 80 candidates on the ballot. So I'm looking forward to how the discussion ensues for the runoffs and where people can be a little bit more focused. And I think on the state level, it was very interesting for me to see the results as well. Disappointing for me, of course. The little bright spot was how younger voters tended to vote, and I'm a Democrat, so it was a little bit hard to watch. I can't really believe actually how many newcomers there are in the state, I was wondering how that was going to play out, because I think when you're doing polling, the polling tends to call people who voted in previous elections. So those of you that are in this room that vote a lot get a lot of polling, a lot of direct mail, and those who don't get very much. And so I was really curious about that, both on the local and on the state level. So we saw a lot, and I know we'll talk more about the local numbers.
I know, I think a lot of the opposition to the rail, probably most of it, was the tax increases involved with the measure. What was the message from last night about property taxes in Austin?
I think there was a pretty clear. I don't know. Maybe you should separate the property tax question from the issue of the rail bond, because the ACC bonds did pass, so there were some other cross currents that happened. I got the sense that people were sending a message that they're not just going to vote willy nilly for something that the sense was thrown on the ballot at the last second. I think when you look at that in contrast to what happened on the statewide level with the statewide Proposition 1 for transportation funding, which passed overwhelmingly with over 3 million votes, Texans support and they embrace transportation solutions. But I think it's a long, having in a former life, I was the chairman of the Department of Transportation, and I saw firsthand it takes a long time to convince Texans of the need, not just for more roads, but also rail, a multimodal solution for transportation. I spent 3.5 years at the Department of Transportation working just on that, just educating people about the need and what the solutions are. And what we saw at the statewide level was the result. I suspect that conversation needs to be had much in a much more broad way in the city of Austin before significant things like that are something that the voters of Austin are going to even consider.
I would agree with Deirdre about the separating the property tax and the question of rail. I think though that some folks in this room would probably like to remind us that there was a process involved there, and I think that those folks would argue that there was the process was data driven. I think that there was a struggle to get that message home. I think that there was a struggle to get the message that the project was the first of what could have been a much larger system. I think that all of that probably played into the decision. I think, when I'm watching conversations, especially on social media, which of course we all know is something of a deal these days, the megaphone I think went to folks locally who were pro transit but anti this package for a variety of different reasons, and the conversation that comes next, and what's next is going to be, I think, deeply fascinating. I think you'll have folks who still want the focus to be on roads. You'll have folks who want the focus to be on one route or a series of routes in particular, and you'll have folks who sort of want to be involved and talk about transportation and the broader needs of transportation. I think I would disagree with the notion that you can come back in 10 years and get this thing, 2 years, and get it back on the ballot. I think that's far-fetched.
And I think it was about money. I mean, I do think people just do not have an appetite for adding to their tax bills, and this was a very expensive proposal. I also think that if you looked at what was in the roads package, you kind of see how the wheeling and dealing goes, the trading that happens when you put that kind of package together on a ballot, and that's the process of what most outside perceive as an insider game. And actually, I'm kind of interested in the roads piece, especially with the districts that you're going to now see a different process for what gets added into the queue. And, there weren't you know, for instance, a lot going on in Northwest and Southwest in the package to satisfy those voters, and they turned out and voted. And so I think that's going to be a real different dynamic as we see how transportation solutions go forward. It's very centrally focused. And also the other thing is the people have in Austin also don't seem to – I didn't look at what happened in Westlake, but there's a real difference in the way that our regional approach has happened here. And so there's a, you know, when Cedar Park or other outlying areas aren't necessarily participating at the same rate that Austin citizens are, I think there's a perception that Austin citizens don't want to pay for things that people further out are the ones who are causing, you know, so much of the stress. So that's going to be something we're going to have to look at much more from a regional perspective, I think, going forward.
Well, it was predicted this would be a historical election for Austin that would increase the numbers at the polls. I think that was accomplished last night.
Well,
or maybe not.
I think if you look at the numbers, they're very close to the gubernatorial race in 2012. I think that there are probably some folks out there who were hoping for a much larger turnout. I think that actually brings up an interesting point. I mean, how the goal here, of course, was to get more folks interested. And there was a very measurable metric there with 78 candidates. That happened. Whether people stay interested and stay involved, I think that's another question. And I think that's one we'll be watching as things move forward.
And I'd like to point out, I mean, turnout in any election is a function of the top of the ballot. While there was a lot of interest in the city council, but it was always going to be determined by the gubernatorial race. And there was a lot of hope and expectation that there was going to be a groundswell of new voters, as was mentioned earlier, voting this time. And it didn't happen. I went to bed about 3 a.m., so I didn't see the latest numbers. But when I went to bed, and that was about 90% of the precincts reporting statewide, turnout in the 2014 election was below turnout in the 2010 gubernatorial midterm elections. So I think eventually it'll probably even out. But when you're talking about a state with the growth that we have in Texas, and when you're talking about the efforts that were put in and a lot of the talk, particularly like groups like Battleground Texas, about turning out new voters, energizing Hispanics, women, it just didn't happen.
Yeah. I agree with that. And I actually not sure. Mike knows the numbers better than I do, and I was really frustrated last night because I actually tried to do a little research, and the city's clerk's website was completely down. I don't know if anybody else,
yeah,
you found that to be true, because I was really curious as well. And I was going to answer yes and no. Actually, we do have more people who voted in the mayoral race than we've had in the past because it is a November election, but this November election had less voters in the city race than the election in 2012. And 2012 was the election where we had a lot of propositions on the ballot that included, you know, whether we were going to move to the districts. And again, you know, in the 2012 AISD school board at large race, we saw 135,000 votes cast. Yesterday, we saw 95,000. In the total registered voters, at least, again, I really regret that the city's site wasn't up when it needed to be, but it looked to me like 445,000 people voted in the city of Austin, registered voters in 2012. I'm sorry, there were 445,000 registered voters in the city in 2012 and 517,000 today. So we actually grew in the number of registered voters, and yet the number of voters who actually cast a ballot in the city races, 208,000 last night, 300,000 in 2012. So that's a big change. So yes and no. And I think the reason why we saw less people participate in the city races was because of this paralysis that I mentioned before. I don't know if we'll be able to get everybody to go back out in the runoff. I hope that it's a successful process. But, you know, the mayor's races, the thing that's always, I remember very vividly when I was a candidate was meeting with former mayor Roy Butler, who used to keep a sheet in his drawer that he would take out, and he would point out that, you know, when he got over 40,000 votes in the 1971 election, and there was something like 67% of the people who voted, it was the first election where the mayor was elected at large rather than from the existing council body. And we have not had a mayor elected to this day since then with that many votes. Not ever. And last night, Mike Martinez, you know, got more votes than he's ever gotten in any of his races on city council, over 52,000 votes, and Steve Adler got 64,000 votes. So, I mean, that's significant, I think, and important. But still, as a percentage of how many people could have voted, it's still, less than it was in the... again, in the 40% range, not the 67% range that we used to see in the 70s. So that's not really it. So that's a yes and no to your question.
And if I could add to that, and I was looking at numbers that may be a little bit earlier than yours. The ones that I have are 189 about in rail, 174 mayoral, and then 166 in the district. So you're seeing that trend sort of carry down through into district races, which, of course, is interesting. In an election that was that a lot of folks came out for, that folks were hoping that folks would come out for to participate and vote in local, very local races, district races. Folks didn't make it all the way down.
And, of course, December runoff, something brand new for Austin. And what should we see in this process, do you think?
And you're going to see... maybe 50% of what turned out in a, when you look historically across the state on turnout in these types of November elections with quick December runoffs, you see generally 50% turnout. So I think that's what you can expect. I mean, for candidates, it allows them to focus a little bit because you know who voted, and the best predictor of voting is previous voting. So, everyone in this room who voted, prepare for the deluge. It's coming. They know you voted. But the flip side of that is I can't imagine there's going to be a lot of resources behind these races, particularly these city council races. So it's going to be very interesting to see how in these runoffs these candidates try to communicate with these very targeted voters with the limited resources that they're probably going to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm. The resources question is an interesting one, of course. I think, locally we're seeing just an awful lot of money spent. I think it's fair to say, Randy, and you probably know this better than I do, but I think probably unprecedented amounts of dollars in this race. Another 6 weeks, and again, I've not taken part in an election, so I don't know what it's like in terms of the pocketbook, but another 6 weeks, it's going to be expensive, especially when you're trying to reach a targeted set of voters.
Yeah, I mean, running in a citywide election when, 50,000 people vote is a really different thing than when maybe 200,000 people vote. But there's no question that the mayor's race has been a much more, actively funded campaign than we've seen in the past. At the city council races, it's been way less. And I think a lot of people have been sort of holding off spending and investing in races because they've been waiting to see. They wanted to see who was going to kind of where the dust was going to settle and who to, invest in. And I also think that, when people really think about what a state rep, because when we talked about the districts, I remember talking to my friend Mark Strama about, what does it cost to run in a district like his? And it was roughly $200,000, and that's roughly what you'd have to raise to run in a citywide. And that was, his district was essentially the size of a council district, and to really reach voters. And so I expect that we'll see pretty active fundraising and probably even maybe more going into these runoff races, at least in certain districts. I mean, some of the districts, there were very little money raised and very little money spent. And I think if you look at the school board race, that was kind of a real interesting one. The Statesman did a story on it this morning, but just a couple highlights on that was, the woman that spent $100 and endorsed somebody else came in second place.
Yeah.
versus, the candidate who spent, $90,000 and ran TV ads. So I think, that's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. And on the districts we're talking, I think District 3 is a great example of a district where it took not very much money to run. I think Susanna Almanza led fundraising there. I think she came up with $12,000 or something like that. And that was enough to get her the first place in a very crowded field.
Yeah, but she was the only woman.
She was the only
woman. And that was, I think, a significant thing. And it was definitely a campaign where there was some much lower voter turnout. That was the other thing I thought was interesting, was actually if you looked at the voter turnout by the districts, The places that had traditionally had higher turnout still have higher turnout, mm-hmm. and the places that have lower voter turnout still have lower voter turnout. Again, I don't know if more people in that District 3, for example, that was one of those that I really wanted to look up, was, you know, by those precincts. I just didn't have the bandwidth to do that last night or this morning before taking my son to school. But, you know, I think it's clear that in the district races, those that were, you know, sort of District 4, District 3, typically low voter turnout, had roughly 10 to 11, 12,000 votes cast in those races. And in the other races, you know, where you usually saw bigger voter turnout, West, Northwest, you had 20. Southwest, you had, you know, each district ended up having 22,000 roughly votes. So that's a different.
I did have the time to look that up.
Yeah, good. I'm sure you did.
And you're dead on.
Yeah.
You're dead on.
So.
We have got a lot of questions about the runoffs. And a question that stuck out was, you know, if a candidate is down 10 points in this election, is it possible for them to make up that ground in 6 weeks?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not an expert in city politics. I'm an observer of city politics. But from my experience at the statewide level, you see it all the time. I mean, Congressman Mike McCauley represents this area. He in his first election for Congress, he was down by double digits going into the runoff and ended up winning. It happens all the time where people who are in second place come back and win. So it's absolutely doable. I mean, it's a little bit harder if you're talking about someone's at 49 point. I saw one that was like 49.1%.
The next, yeah, yeah. District 9.
I mean, so.
And that was a race where there were really two major candidates and one that was, you know.
Yeah.
So that was, I was going to say, it's a different. But it's a different formula than if you say we're to look at District 10, where the first place
right.
person had 30%, the second and third place people both had close to
20%,
and the two of them are more likely to be aligned against, you know, against the person who came in first. So
even if you have like a 45-35 split, I mean, it's doable. It happens all the time.
Yeah, I think it totally depends on which race we're talking about and what the mix is. But the other thing is that it's with such small voter turnout, it's always about who can get the voter turnout. So if Chris Riley were to pursue, you know, if he pursues this and he gets a completely different group of people, to turn out, you have a different mix. If it's the exact same people, then it will likely be pretty much the same exact result.
Got another one?
Isn't it true that the majority of council seats are female, and what does that tell us?
I think that I was talking with someone this morning, and there is, I think that there's a good possibility, I think, of 8 female council members coming in this time. You know, one might argue that the Wendy Davis effect was trickled down. One also might argue that it didn't, and I think that you just had always. And before you guys get on me for being too academic here, I think you might argue that you had a lot of good candidates who were very talented politicians.
Yeah, I actually, that was one of the things that, if asked the question, you know, what's going to be different with the new council, aside from the fact that it's, for the first time, pretty much all new people, except for probably one, you know, depending, I mean, of the council members, I'm not talking about the mayor's race, the fact that it's going to be majority women, you know, is also a big change. And just to give you a little bit of historic perspective, in 2005, which doesn't feel like that long ago, when I think that's when Councilmember Martinez was elected, right? Was it 2006? Okay, so in 2005 then, I'm sorry, 2005, there was still this perception that there was one woman seat, one African-American seat, one Hispanic seat. And so this, I think, you know, the two big things are we already have certainty that we will have ethnic diversity without a gentleman's agreement. You know, we also have absolute certainty that there's no longer the idea of a woman's seat. But actually in the race in 2005 when Jennifer Kim ran in that race, there was a guy named Greg Knapp, who some of y'all know, who ran in that race, and it was replacing, I guess, Jackie Goodman, and so people thought, well, place 3 is always the woman's seat. So, you know, that's not that long ago. And so it's really, I'm really excited about that. Big change. And I hope the women can do better than the men have done.
Got another? Go ahead. Any more questions? Just please send them in. We've got some more, I think.
Just want to point out, you know, first Hispanic woman in the history of...
That's right.
That's a Dilly Garza.
Yeah, Dilly Garza. I was going to say that. Thank you.
First Hispanic woman...
Elected.
If you didn't hear, Mike.
Yeah.
Elected.
Mm-hmm. You know, again, it's with absolute certainty that we're going to have, you know, likelihood of more than one Hispanic on the council, more than one African American. It's pretty exciting.
And of course, you know, one of the things we'll be looking for is whether or not this carries forward. And I think that goes back to that question of, you know, how long will the interest stay? Even if we're not going to say that that the turnout was as spectacular as some folks had hoped for today or yesterday. Still today, maybe. The question. You know, there were a fair number of votes yesterday. How long are folks going to want to keep track of the council? How many? You know, more races are we going to have? Probably not many more with 78 candidates. But can we get 50 candidates? Can we get? You know, is that going to trickle down to 25? And does the diversity keep up? I think those are two open questions. Two big questions.
And in most cities, when I explored the change to a district, I had done some research into this, pretty much every place you see a bump the first time and then it goes right back to the way it was. And so that's what happened in Dallas, that's what happened in Houston, that's what's happened in San Antonio, certainly in Texas that's been the case. However, moving the elections from May to November will pretty much guarantee that the numbers will not be 50,000 people voting in city elections again. So, I mean, the fact that is a significant, that probably was more of a structural change than going from, you know, an all at large to a now, to now being something that's in November. On the other hand, because it's November, you also have more partisanship. You have some things that weren't as much at play when you have a May election, and that's been the case in other cities as well.
I've got a question.
Do you foresee a change in the city managership?
the current city manager... I couldn't predict. I wouldn't have thought he would have been here as long as he's been. So I don't really know. That might be a question for Councilmember Martinez.
I think that one of the things that you hear around is that maybe not just a change in the current city manager, but a change in governmental structure. I think Randy can certainly talk more about the unwieldiness of government, but you know, now you're talking about four more council members, and a very, very large government. You hear sometimes, you know, again in the conversations that you have, you know, is it fair to have an appointed executive, which is a political question, of course. I think that the rumbles are out there, and we might see something.
But you have to also consider the form of government. I mean, I don't think a lot of people in Austin really give a lot of thought to that. And I'm not saying people in this room, because y'all are obviously thought leaders and active in the community and are paying more attention to this. But, you know, our form of government in Austin is now pretty much exactly like Dallas, where we have a professional city manager who's a chief executive who reports to the city council. The council does not have administrative responsibility. In Houston, that is not the case. And so in Houston, you know, it's a very different thing. Our county officials have administrative responsibilities to run the business of the county. That is not the way the city is. So if we want to change that, that's another big question for the voters to consider. And that's another like long history lesson that I'm not the expert on, but it's really, you know, whether or not you're a city that's got a city manager council form of government versus a strong mayor form of government. You know, most big cities have had strong mayors. Austin came up as a smaller city that is now a bigger city, so that's kind of why we're in the situation that we're in. The good thing, though, is that because it is new people and it's going to take some time for them to get their sea legs or, you know, get things figured out, there's a whole different way of doing business with 10 versus 6 council members and a mayor. It's just going to be really different. So I think that, you know, we do have a very good professional staff for the most part at our city. I think people's recycling bins are going to continue to get picked up. I don't think it's not going to be major changes that everybody, you know, you're going to dial 911 and it's still going to work. So, that's a good thing about having the professional staff we have.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question for Deirdre. What do you think it'll... how will this new state leadership, you know these folks, is it going to change anything?
I think philosophically and ideologically, it's very similar to what you've seen in the past. I think, Greg Abbott essentially ran on a platform of continuing the policies of Governor Perry. I think the big difference people are going to see with the new crop of both legislators and statewide elected officials coming in is a difference in style. We haven't seen this much turnover in the Austin statewide leadership since 2002. I mean, you got to keep in mind, there are kids in high school who have only known one governor. And Rick Perry cast a very large shadow over the Capitol. He had legislative experience in addition to agency experience. He knew how the building worked. He knew how the culture worked. And he's a gut player. I mean, he knows what he believes, and he's not afraid to do what he believes is the right thing to do. You know, Abbott doesn't bring that kind of experience. He brings a legal background, a judicial background to the office, no legislative experience, and he's a very deliberative person. So I think there's going to be a very difference in style in the chief executive. And then when it comes to the legislature, I think what everyone's waiting to see is how the relationship develops between Joe Strauss, who is likely to be reelected Speaker of the House, who's, you know, perceived as a more moderate Republican. I always have to do air quotes because, you know, a moderate Republican in Texas is still like a crazy right-wing conservative anywhere else. But so Strauss, who's been there and is going to be reelected, but, you know, got to get through that business of getting him reelected. And Dan Patrick, who's going to be the lieutenant governor, who is, you know, makes no apologies for his positions. I mean, I think everyone was a lot of people were surprised, I wasn't, because I know Dan pretty well, that he ran such a strident race in the general election coming off a very strident primary. And I was like, that's Dan. He's not going to change. So the lieutenant governor and the speaker will have a very different approach and very different bodies to deal with. The House is pretty much a similar makeup as it was in the last time around. But the Senate is going to be way more conservative. You have 8 new senators, most of them elected largely under the Tea Party mantle. And they don't care that this is the way we've always done it for the last 50 years, so we got to keep on doing it. They're coming in, the new ones are coming in very unified, and they're coming in with an attitude of we're going to do things differently. I suspect that will lead to interesting fireworks between the two bodies, which always happens, and people, oh, it's the end of the world, we're not going to get anything done. We always get it done. That's the good news. There will be a budget, which is the one thing we have to do. So I just think there's going to be a growing period in Austin where you have all these new people coming in and how they're going to work with each other. They're going to have to figure that out, and it's unfortunate they get sworn in and they immediately go into a legislative session. So it is trial by fire. There's no time to sort of, you know, figure it out, but they'll figure it out. They always do. But it'll be interesting to watch.
How's the working relationship between Kirk Watson and Dan Patrick?
You know, I don't know. Honestly, I don't. I know them both, but I don't know what their relationship is. I think it's fair to say the Senate is going to be a more partisan body than it has traditionally and historically been. The first thing that will happen when they come in is there will be not the first thing, because actually Dewhurst will preside over the Senate for a week before Dan Patrick even gets sworn in. But there will be very soon a debate on the rules and the traditional two-thirds rule where every bill has to have two-thirds support of the Senate will get changed. It'll be some other percentage. Who knows what that percentage is going to be. So the Senate will start off on a very partisan, very rancorous tone. And so we'll see. And I fully expect, you know, Dan Patrick will be pushing the change, and I fully expect Kirk Watson will be on the other side pushing against very vocally. So we'll see how the relationship develops throughout the legislative session.
Running up to the election, there was a lot of talk about, demographics slowly turned the state at least purple. Mm-hmm. Did that turn out to be a myth, or
looks that way?
Well, I mean, the exit polling sure shows that all of the promises made by Battleground Texas, they absolutely failed in what they said they were going to do. I mean, the exit polling shows that Abbott got 44% of the Hispanic vote. He
let me see, I've got it right here. He, you know, he, 44%, he, I think he came close to winning Hispanic men. I think it was very close among Hispanic men. I think you see overall the turnout was pretty much the same. I think it is a mistake for people to assume just because you're Hispanic, you're a Democrat. And that has been the functioning thought behind the Texas Democrat Party, and also the folks from Washington when they come in, they say we're gonna turn Texas purple and eventually blue. That's not the case. And I think Greg Abbott did a very good job, and he was very persistent and single-minded on going down to the Hispanic community, whether it's in the Rio Grande Valley or in Houston, Dallas, or wherever the Hispanics were, and making the case directly to them to vote for him. And it worked. And if Republicans are smart, and we can continue to build on that and talk with Hispanics, have a conversation with Hispanics on the issues that matter, we may not win Hispanics, but when you're winning 44, 45, 46% of Hispanics as a Republican, it's really hard for a Democrat to win.
Yeah. Let's talk about January, the new council getting together with the new mayor. What should be the mayor's role in trying to get everybody to maybe not vote rubber stamp, but to get some consensus going in the council?
Well, I mean, I think just from being a guy who sits at council meetings and spends a lot of time there, I would sure like to see somebody who can wrangle a bunch of folks. I think it's going to be
a bunch of women.
Let's point that out. A bunch of women. Although, you know,
we can safely assume we're going to have a male mayor and a majority women in the council. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, and I think you know, there are going to be a lot of folks up there who have not yet had a chance to, you know, legislate, and there's going to need to be some kind of order, you know, and that's going to be real important to make sure things get done. You're also, for the first time in a very long time, going to have some folks with very differing ideological views, and how that plays into how things get done will also be interesting, and you'll need probably a mayor who can get folks past that and, you know, move ahead and do the business of the city, which, as I'm sure Randy will tell you, is making sure the budget is right.
And I have the great privilege of knowing both Mike Martinez and Steve Adler very well, and their wives. And they have absolutely fabulous wives. And Mike's here. I think if Steve were here, he'd say the same thing. It's the better half. Their wives are amazing. And so these are both men who will work very well with a woman-dominated council, I have a feeling.
Just throwing it out there, Mike.
Well, they do have great wives, and that says a lot about these guys, both of them.
I found it fascinating that the female effect, if you will, is it significantly more prominent at the county level. We'll have our first female county judge, I think, and majority female commissioner's court.
Yes, that's right.
Across the county, it's majority in district courts are female and so forth.
Very good point.
Common. In terms of governance or anything else. Mr. May also want to comment.
Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I don't have a microphone, but I've got a lot of comments.
And you have a loud voice, so go for it.
I had my time up there. I mean, yeah, it will be a very, very interesting commissioner's court starting in January.
Yeah. Another city question, but what does the passage of the ACC bond mean?
Well, yeah, I got to be honest. I did not follow the ACC stuff too closely. I'll go ahead and take a stab at the notion that people are at least willing to spend money in at least a couple of places. Is sort of my take home there.
I agree with that. And they seemed to be modest proposals next to the rail proposal. So I do think that there's some psychology around that. I mean, there was a fear that might have that effect of making all of it go down. But I think it was easier for people to say no and then still feel good about saying yes to ACC. I think that might have worked on some people's psychology. I did talk to some voters, again, anecdotally, walking out of the polls, and I did hear that kind of a comment. So that may have had something to do with it.
That's interesting.
Robert, can I say one thing about
Sure, that? Gerald Daugherty, Travis County Commissioner.
My comment on that, Randy, or in response to what you just said, anytime that you have a proposition before the community and you don't have legitimate opposition to it, it is likely to pass.
Good point.
That is the reason I think that ACC passed. ACC is a great organization. Probably 90% of the people in this community understand it. But you started out by saying that affordability was a huge deal. And ACC is just fortunate that it didn't have legitimate opposition, which is what the rail had. You don't have to tit for tat money raised to defeat something, but you have to have enough money and you have to have enough energy to get it out there so that it becomes synergistic. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I think
because they didn't just overwhelmingly, it wasn't like Prop 1 state where it was just a landslide. So I think that if you had opposition to it, it would have had a more difficult time, but
yeah, and there were, but likewise, Proposition 1 at the state level spent a lot of money on marketing that ACC was sort of under the radar. So I just think, you know, there was Statesman endorsement, there was Chronicle endorsement, there was not a lot of discussion, like you said, both pro or con. And so it's a really good point. But I do think people associate education as something where it's, you know, part of our economic development. It's a little bit different. Although the school bond elections have failed in the past, and that was so that's, again, that typically tends to happen when it's not, when there's, you know, horse trading that goes on, and some people didn't get things in their package and other people didn't. And I don't think ACC really faced that either as they put together what they proposed.
I wonder if it would be appropriate to discuss this in context of the 2012 med school vote, where you had one clear expenditure, a big expenditure, but a very clear vote. You know, there was a lot of effort on the folks who worked to get that passed on their part to make sure that there wasn't much else, you know, running either against it or against it in the other way, and that one, you know, pretty clearly, if my memory serves, didn't happen this time with rail.
There have been a lot of questions about rail as well, as in, you know, is this thing put to bed, or, you know, how long until there's a new plan out there that we'll be talking about this again?
I mean, from my perspective, from looking at the political and then coming from a transportation policy background, I don't see how they come back from this politically. It wasn't even close. And then, so let's say it takes 10 years for them to feel like they can bring it back. Well, in 10 years, Austin continues to grow. And it becomes more expensive. And so that billion-dollar bond package looks like a deal in 10 years. And it makes it harder to put the lines where people who are, you know, if you even come to consensus about where the line should be, it's much harder and much more expensive. Rail has worked in cities where the city has grown up around rail, not where the city has tried to force rail in. And I'm a proponent. I mean, I served statewide and came to TxDOT and said, we can't just focus on roads. It's got to be multimodal. Rail has got to be part of the solution. And I honestly don't see how rail has a future in Austin after the beating it took yesterday.
I think the other thing to take into account is, you know, the three votes that we've had in the last, I guess, 14 years on rail. The one successful one was for a very limited system, and I don't know if I wholly agree with the idea that it's completely dead. I think that there are a lot of advocates out there who are very vocal, who will do their very best to try to bring it back. Like I said at the top, I think that 2 years from now, having a real proposition is I just can't see how that happens. But I know that there are going to be folks out there working real hard to try and do that. And let's not forget that rail isn't the only transportation option here. I mean, you know, there are buses, all kinds of things that will have to factor in the discussion as we try to, you know, determine how we're going to move forward.
Don't forget gondolas downtown.
Oh, yeah.
Still alive. Somebody mentioned putting a ferry on on the Colorado River here, going back and forth. Yeah. Hey, we'll think about anything these days. So what does the council do? They meet in January and about... There's going to be tremendous pressure to do something about traffic.
Well, as I said earlier, I think that the the discussion is going to be really different when it comes to traffic when you have district representation. Mm-hmm. That is probably the place where you're going to see the most difference. And I was not a big proponent for the district, because I've seen in Dallas how it has created the sort of horse trading, the fiefdom, and the there's issues of concern. And Austin, one of the things about Austin that's been great is that we have this great sense of city. And I didn't really, I do hope that whoever the mayor is continues to really promote that and doesn't. We don't have a district rep who doesn't. They're voting on the budget that affects every citizen, including the 85% that didn't actually elect them. And so I do think that's really important. And I hope that we don't have people who are dealing with a zoning case that don't have somebody else who's willing to cross over and talk about fairness and help across district lines. And I hope that the mayor, whoever the mayor is, will facilitate that. But on transportation, that really was an issue for me. Was I'm the person who's always been all over Austin. I mean, my parents recently moved from Dallas here. They were living out near Cedar Park, so I'm on 183 all the time. And I can't tell you how many people at City Hall are not on 183. I cannot tell you how many people participating in the meetings never go south of the river. Or if they do, it's barely. It's like maybe to here, But the idea, of going all the way to Barton Creek West or heading out to Travis Country is just, not something they do. And I literally have had offices in this city when I ran my business that were in every, part of the city. I mean, at one point I was at Cameron and 183 East, and I was also out at 360 and 2222, and I'm there all the time. I mean, my son's best friend lives in Avery Ranch, so I'm all over the place and a citizen of the whole city, and I just didn't sense that when I was at City Hall. And so I'm really happy that we're going to have council members who are driving from these places every day who will voice that when they're coming up with the process for, again, I know I'm not idealistic. I know it'll be some horse trading, but that's okay when it comes to transportation, because I think you'll start seeing some solutions in the northwest parts of town and the southwest parts of town that won't be dominated by, a central Austin discussion. So I think that will help.
But I always want to wrap up with a call to action for the folks in the room to get out there. Y'all are so involved. You're here early after Election Day. That says a lot. And just maybe give a recommendation for how to make what we've learned today, put it into action, that it's for the good of Austin.
I guess I was really involved in the statewide Prop 1, which won with over 80%. We were very excited about that, but that was, that's only a part of the solution. It's about a little less than $2 billion a year to TxDOT. TxDOT is going to need about another $2 to $3 billion. The legislature's coming to town in January, and transportation is on the top of the agenda for almost all the elected leadership, which has never happened before, so I'm hopeful of getting something done. But that will only happen if folks who care about transportation, and transportation only works best when it is a partnership and a cooperation between the state and the locals. So it matters what the state does, it matters what the locals do, so voice your concern. Tell your elected representatives in Austin that you care about transportation and it needs to be a priority as they're coming up with the budget this time.
I would say if you're not already deeply engaged in some kind of way with the city, get deeply engaged with the city. I think that the new council is going to, I think it's going to be a challenge for those folks. I think they can use all the help they can get.
Well, my call to action is if you're somebody who votes, definitely vote in the runoff and bring five friends, who aren't likely to vote, and understand that the way it is when you're a candidate on a limited budget is you are going to spend money on direct mail and robocalls to the people that you think are the most likely to vote, which means if you're going to be writing and communicating with the people who have already voted. So bring more people. I mean, Leadership Austin has this incredible network of people. I was very active in this community. I was in Leadership Austin in 1998, the best class ever. And there's a couple of my classmates in the room. Thank you. But listen, I never went to a single city council meeting, not one, until I was sworn in. And I have not been to one since I was sworn out. And that doesn't mean I'm not super active in this community. I'm still doing a ton of stuff. And it was a great experience. And I'm a much better community volunteer because I have a better sense for how things work at City Hall. I want to applaud Gerald and Mike for stepping up and doing the jobs they do. It is really hard work. People know less about what the county does sometimes than what the city does. And it is really impacting, you know, your lives every day. And so it is worth paying attention to. And I am a much better volunteer because I know a little bit more about how that works. And I don't have any desire to go back to City Hall, but I can tell you that, you know, we need to thank the people who are willing to do it, because it is really hard and many times thankless and painful, mean-spirited at times. It's really hard. So thank them for their service and pay attention and bring five friends to the ballot box when the runoff comes.
Wow, what a great conversation. A lot to process. My name is Julie Smith. I'm the program manager for the Engage Breakfast Series. Again, thank you to our wonderful panel, and thank you to everybody for being here today, for being a part of this really important conversation. Please continue to stay involved over the next few months. There's going to be a lot to process and to be a part of, and I look forward to having your voices and to seeing you all out there. I do hope to see you next week at our Civic Summit. Registration for that will open up this afternoon on our website, so please visit. And we'll be back here on December the 3rd, and we'll be talking about the state-level decisions and how those will be impacting us on the city and county level. So hope to see you back here. Have a great day.